Inside Julia's Kitchen is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill. With Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting healthy food that tastes great. Visit bobsredmill.com today.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. This show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people who we have the great fortune of learning from on a regular basis. On today's show, we welcome Jenny Dorsey, professional chef, artist, food writer, and culinary consultant. She leads Wednesdays, a New York City-based pop-up supper club, Studio Atao, which marries augmented reality and virtual reality with food, and is the co-host of our sister Heritage Radio Network podcast, Why Food? About career changers. In today's episode, we'll learn about the many paths to success in the food world, how virtual reality infiltrates food, and we'll hear Jenny's Julia moment. Stay tuned to learn what is a Julia moment. We'll be right back. In our first segment on Inside Julia's Kitchen, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. Julia Child is often thought of as a career changer. She was nearly 50 when Mastering the Art of French Cooking was published, and the French Chef television series made her a national TV star. Julia would be the first to admit that until she landed in France, she had no idea what she wanted to do with her life, other than thinking there should be more to it than just being Mrs. Paul Child. While she'd famously joined the World War II effort, serving in the OSS, where she met her husband, Paul, and before that had tried to be a novelist, to work in advertising without much success, Julia really didn't have a career to change from. It should also be pointed out that in this period, the late 40s and early 50s, the career options available to women, especially well-brought-up, even college-educated women like Julia, were pretty limited. But literally upon arrival in France, Julia had her aha moment. Her discovery was not only that great food nourished her, it also completely captivated her. And with one meal, a fire was lit that led to the creation of a culinary icon. All because Julia discovered something she was truly passionate about, and then pursued it with great vigor. This brings us to today's guest, Jenny Dorsey, who's an expert on career changes, having done a complete 180 to arrive at cooking and has now become a diverse food world multi-hyphenate. We were introduced to Jenny when she became a 2017 Les Dames d'Escoffier Legacy Award recipient, a terrific mentoring and professional development program for women, by women, supported by the foundation. Welcome to the podcast, Jenny.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
We're delighted you're on. So you do so many fascinating forward-looking things in food, it's kind of hard to pick where to start. But let's delve into what you cover in your podcast, Career Changing, and specifically Career Changing into Food. So tell us about your own journey into food. How did that happen?
Well, I started my career in management consulting within the fashion and luxury world. I always kind of had this strange idea that I wanted to be in fashion. I don't honestly know where it came from. I think it was a facade I wanted to see of myself. So after college, I went to college in Seattle, where I'm from. I moved out to New York City, you know, the big city, and started my career. And I you know, I think I loved so many, I liked the show of it, saying that I was doing this, saying that I could wear these clothes and buying these things, but I was really unhappy. I was really, really thin. I didn't eat very much. I was obsessed with constantly buying these clothes, and I actually put myself in like a net negative occasionally. I would buy so much because it's kind of like filling this hole in your life with things. And eventually I woke up one day and said, I can't do this anymore. I'm unhappy. I don't know why I'm unhappy. I look at the partners in my firm and I don't want their life. So what am I even, you know, striving for? And as opposed to making really like a radical shift, I was definitely risk averse and scared. So I ended up applying to the Columbia Business School, early decision. Got in and essentially had like a year before I had to actually go to school. And was like, okay, this is my time. What am I going to do with, you know, this year of freedom? I totally planned on going back into consulting, where the money was, you know, where like the stable career was. And ended up going to culinary school because I loved it. That was always the thing that drew me back. It was always the thing that I wanted to do. It was what I did with all my free time and with all my other discretionary income that I didn't really have after I bought all those clothes. Went to school and I graduated from culinary school 3 days before I started at Columbia. Went to Columbia for a semester and was like, oh my God, I have to be in food. You know, like I am going down the wrong path again. I need to figure out what I can do in food. And this is like who I am. I just need to find my place within it, even if it doesn't, it's not the traditional food path either as working in a restaurant or being a private chef or any of that. So yeah, it's been quite a journey and it's been challenging at times, but I'm happy to have done it. It's better on the other side than when I started.
So it sounds like there were kind of two parts to it. The first was you realized you were unhappy in what you were doing and you proactively made a change, but then it wasn't the full direction. But during this sort of interim, you gave yourself a treat to pursue a passion, which is really when the whole thing started to change more dramatically. That the going to culinary school for you was like kind of a reward. It wasn't actually a purposeful step to become a chef per se.
Exactly. I definitely didn't, you know, anticipate longevity in the field. I had never, you know, treated it as a career change at the time. I was like, oh, this is just me. Like, this is a creative exercise before I go into a lifelong, you know, journey of being miserable again. That sounds so silly now, but that was really what I was thinking and thought that would be okay. And the minute I stepped foot in culinary school, I mean, like, first of all, I was around so many different types of people I generally didn't interact with before, a lot of other career changers, because I was going to work and going to school at the same time. So I was in the evening program and people with these kind of like interesting different backgrounds that made me appreciate other people in a way when before I was all wrapped up in like, oh, what are, you know, at first it was grades and then it was like promotions and then it was how much people are making. It gave me this kind of holistic view of like what I was missing out in looking in for the good in other people, and kind of that translated into like looking into myself and being like, I don't have to be only my personality and who I am isn't based on all these factors that I've deemed important. It's really about, you know, how happy I am, how I treat other people, what, you know, good I can do for the world.
Now, I'm guessing that that's a great revelation, and especially in terms of that working in food can be so holistically emotional and gratifying. I'm assuming those are conclusions, though, you arrived at over time, not the day you graduated from culinary school or the day that you quit Columbia Business School.
I think it took a while to, well, I think like graduating from culinary school and then going right back into the business school, the juxtaposition, so it was so rapid that definitely helped spur this realization of like something different. I don't know what's different. And then kind of realizing, hey, when I was in culinary school, I was around people who might not have gone to the Ivy Leagues that everyone else I'm now surrounded with. They don't make that much money. They have, you know, kids that they're, you know, they're struggling with their mortgage, but like these people are wonderful people, and you're able to see a bigger picture. And then going right back into like everyone works at Goldman and wants to talk about their whatever, you know, deal that they just landed. You're like, oh my God, what's happening here? Like there's something that doesn't jive with something that I've learned or something that I've internalized and care about now. And I need to figure out how to get back to the, you know, the basis of what I really want, like the person that I want to be. And it's, and I don't think I can develop that person here in this setting at business school.
I think that's a great summation of your aha moment, just like Julia had an aha moment in one meal, so to speak. And so the podcast you co-host on Heritage Radio Network, Why Food, very often asks your guests to reveal their aha moment, which, you know, to me makes a lot of sense. They're usually great stories. But I was curious what you think about in your evolutionary process and in talking to people about your experiences, what do you think aha moments, hearing other people's aha moments, do in terms of helping others figure out, you know, their true self and their true path?
I think there's many different types of aha moments, of course, but the ones that I think are so interesting is many times when we ask the guests their aha moment, and then, you know, they take a few minutes to think about it right before we go on air. A lot of times the aha moment is not, you know, I woke up, you know, in bed one day and realized this. It started way before, when they were a teenager, or sometimes when they were even a kid, and they trace back to this one memory that they were doing. We just had one of the co-founders of Birch Coffee on the show, and he was telling us how when he was in his teens, he drew these floor plans for a nightclub that sold cocktails and eggs, which does not sound very good, but it was so interesting. Like, he's like, I've never thought of that before until you asked me just now. And like, you could kind of see the makings of his career starting from such an early age. And you find that sort of thread through a lot of people's aha moments. Someone else mentioned that they were doing something as a kid, that they were a very adventurous eater. I think to myself, you know, I studied abroad in Italy and had like a great food experience there that was kind of like, you know, just buried in the back of my mind. There's these so many things that I think a lot of times for career changers, they resonate deeply in you, but you kind of shove them down because you pursue this other path, but they just kind of bubble to the surface over time, and eventually you find yourself in food.
And so you think it's almost like hearing other people's aha moments, or the sequence of things that led to the final aha, if you will, it kind of helps trigger or spark deep in someone's memory their own feelings, or to kind of assess, am I doing the right thing?
Yeah, I think if you listen to enough of these stories and kind of use them as a guide for your own, like you think about the memories that you cherish the most, you can string together a story of your life and what you care about, and I think that guides you to the right place. And I also think for a lot of people who are thinking or contemplating about going into food, they have so many of those that, you know, they're scattered about, and once you put them together, there's like, it seems obvious, it almost seems obvious. In hindsight, it always seems obvious, but I think like for those thinking about going to the food, it like, I hope, might propel them forward in realizing that they're very similar to these other entrepreneurs.
So let's say that we're talking out there to folks listening who maybe have pieced together their aha moments and are ready or nearly ready to make a leap, whether it's applying to cooking school or getting a stage in a kitchen, or maybe just picking up mastering the art and trying a recipe. What's your overall advice to people considering, you know, leaping into food, and particularly if they're kind of already in a profession or started a profession and are doing a 180 like you did?
I think the biggest thing is that there's always going to be, you know, people who might not, it's not that they don't support you, they don't get it. There's always going to be people who just don't understand, who are calling to question your decision, all of that. And the most challenging part that I found was simply just ignoring them. I found it almost impossible to ignore. I can recount many nights of worry and crying and talking to my then boyfriend, now husband, about, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing. I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm doing. There's just so much doubt. There's a lot of imposter syndrome. I still have imposter syndrome, but at the beginning, a lot more of that, I think. And it's a big part of making a big change like that is just sticking through with it. The other thing I would say is that, you know, nobody ever really, quote unquote, made it by playing it safe. You know, it's you're worried about making this career change into a world that you're not sure about, and you almost don't want to have a personality in it. For a long time, I played this like, oh, I make all types of cuisines. I don't really have an opinion on any of them. I like all foods. But I that's not true. I have lots of strong opinions. And I think because of that, I've been able to build up more of a brand and more of a following. And that's not going to be for everyone. I don't have to get along with everyone. And I think it's very daunting for someone who's changing into a new career, into a new industry, to want everyone to also accept them. And that's, I don't think it's necessary. And it's just something that you get more comfortable with over time.
And so you did do a culinary course. Do you think going to cooking school or taking a culinary diploma or something like or a certificate is that essential to changing into food, or do you think it works for some people, not for others?
Absolutely. I think it really depends on the person. I liked it because at the time I had no culinary training, and I'm the kind of person that, like, I was so used to having, you know, I want grades, I want a certificate. It helped me feel a little bit more stable and structured. But that being said, I mean, I have a lot of opinions about culinary schools and the way they're set up in this country. And we could take an entire podcast just talking about that. But it was an expensive education. It was tens of thousands of dollars, which, assuming if you're going into restaurants, there's a lot of problems in the restaurant industry right now as well, that it's going to be hard to pay back those loans. I mean, I just paid off, I think, my culinary school loans earlier this year, last year, yeah, since it was the beginning of 2018. And it was not an easy feat. And I definitely think you can get 100% of the things that I learned in culinary school if you work in a kitchen. That being said, working in a restaurant kitchen and trying to learn basic techniques, you really have to be like a self-motivated self-starter, because otherwise no one's going to take the time and be like, this is how you get like the best diced potatoes, or this is how you do these and things. You just have to constantly ask questions, and you have to be in a kitchen that's going to want to teach you. There are kitchens where the chef just does not care. He wants you to be a cog and a robot. And I've been in those kitchens and I left because there's no point in being there. And it's, you know, it's a myopic view of the chef, but we don't need to get into that. It's if you find a kitchen where people want to educate you, then you can learn so much without having to pay for school.
And would your advice, or is your advice to younger cooks and chefs who are coming up who might be in a kitchen where there is no time for mentorship or direction or teaching, would you say to them, change, because it's not going to do you any good, or there are some situations where it still does you good?
Leave, 100% leave. If you're ever being like treated poorly in a kitchen, like, leave. There's such a shortage of cooks right now. Like, I don't want to say like, oh, we have the upper hand, but the kitchen needs you. So if they know that they need you and they can't bother to treat you well, then leave. If they can't give you an upward trajectory, leave. If they can't give you the mentorship and education so that you can also rise to the next level, so that you're not prep cook or fry cook forever, then leave, because no one's going to look out for your career except for you. And you have to take that into your own hands.
I personally think that's great advice. And it should make all executive chefs quake in their boots and start behaving differently. But obviously the pressures of running a kitchen, particularly if you're doing, you know, lunch and dinner service 7 days a week, are quite intense and immense. So I was wondering if you think, having done a career changer, and I think I revealed to you I've done my share of career changes too, do you think if you love food, do you think you're better off waiting and doing something else first? Or if you're already persuaded that you know that's your passion and love, there's no point in trying something else?
I think it depends. Like, when I think back to my earlier career, I mean, usually I don't have so many fun things to say about it, but I will say that I learned a lot of skills that I do use, especially on my consulting business. I think as things as simple as like being good at Microsoft Excel, or like learning how to do project management. Change management was also, I guess that was a specialty I was in within fashion and luxury. So like learning how to manage upwards and downwards, but like manage upwards, get people stakeholders to buy into what you want to change. That is a skill set that I've been able to use in the food world and use effectively. So there's so many things that, you know, past skill sets will always fuse into food, because food is not just about being able to literally cook. I think we all can have seen, you know, chefs who literally are just good at cooking. sometimes make it, but many times they need an operational partner and many other people to really get them to succeed, to success, sorry. So I think however you end up in food, you'll find that whatever you were doing before was helpful in some strange way or another. I've heard so many interesting stories on my podcast of people doing, I don't know, just when they were writing or a comedy writer, or they were in mortgage, or they were in whatever else, a lot of finance to food transitions, and it always comes to play in some way or another.
No, that makes a lot of sense. That made me think about, we at the foundation have been talking to Le Cordon Bleu in London, and they want to launch a new scholarship specifically for career changers and for a specific program that teaches trained chefs how to run a business, because ultimately where the restaurant industry has moved, the big play is to be a chef who can run a restaurant, if not multiple restaurants. And if you only have kitchen and cooking skills, those are fairly different than what it takes to be an entrepreneur, essentially, and a business owner, leader, manager.
Yeah, I was just reading an article about one of the top chefs. I don't know if he won or he was like a fan favorite, but he used to own, you know, one very, very good restaurant, which really blew up after his appearance on Top Chef. And then he tried to expand to multiple restaurants, and now the whole thing, everything is shut down, just expanded too fast. And he was talking about like problems with capital. And that's the big thing I see with a lot of clients too, is just like the problem with working capital and understanding what that means and the impact to your business. And those are things that, you know, you don't get taught in culinary school, and it's hard. You don't want to learn that trial by fire, because it usually results in something getting shut down. And I really believe that like more holistic business training, money training, like, you know, just how to work with finances in this country is really important. And also, I do believe that for career transitions, whatever you were doing before you went into food, it's like it was meant to be, you know?
Yeah, and it then all kind of comes together and you say, wow. So yeah, I think that's to say that the multitude of experiences can all be tapped, particularly because when you work in food, as we're going to talk about when we come back, you could be doing many different things in addition to standing at a stove. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk to Jenny about the intersection of virtual reality and the food world. We'll be right back. With Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed, healthy food that actually tastes good. Visit bobsredmill.com today. Use the discount code JULIASKITCHEN in all caps for valuable savings on Bob's Red Mill products. You can stock up on organic, gluten-free, paleo, and vegan products from oats to flours for a healthy family and happy heart. I have to admit, when I first learned that Jenny worked on virtual reality in relation to food, I was like, what? So I'm intrigued to learn more about two tastes I didn't really realize could go together and I know nothing about. So Jenny, fill me in. What does augmented reality and virtual reality mean in relation to food and the food world?
So first I'll differentiate between the two. Virtual reality, I think most people have seen those geeky pictures of people with like a giant headset on, like looking around and laughing. Those are like the terrible virtual reality stock photos. But that is essentially when you're watching a video that's been engineered, so it looks like it's you're in the scene. So you can turn in all different directions depending on how advances. You might be able to walk around in the space, or perhaps you can just move your head and see different angles of the space. Augmented reality, on the other hand, is where you can see the physical world, but there's an additional layer of visuals on top. So if you've ever used Snapchat, the filters, when you have your own face and then you add like a hat or something, or like the dog tongue, I think was the first
one. The floppy tongue.
And Pokemon Go. It's very, very popular, and that's like kind of the cutesy generic version. And now there's just a lot more in terms of AR for, you know, technical training. There's things that are a lot more, I think, real looking, not as cartoonish, that can be used for different applications. So anyway, I fell into AR VR very randomly last year. I was having another aha moment, I guess. I was at acupuncture and I was trying to start this culinary studio. I wanted to do something for social good. I couldn't figure it out. And I just woke up in the middle of my acupuncture session and was like, AR VR, that's what I have to do. And I went home to my husband. I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And he's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't even know what that is. And I said, me neither. And so that started my AR VR journey, just literally trying to take people out to coffee and ask them about how do you use this and what do you do and what does this mean and have you done anything with food? And people are like, no, food, like what does food have to do with this? And so it took me a really long time to try and piece together what is feasible. Basically, everything is feasible if you have infinite amounts of money, but what's feasible in my current budget and what I really wanted to portray. There are some other restaurants. There's one in Shanghai and there's one in Ibiza in Spain that are doing some VR stuff and AR stuff, but it's very much entertainment focused. And what my focus has been is how do you use AR and VR and combine it with food for some sort of like social good? How do you give back to the world that has given so much? I mean, for me, like, the world gives you so much amazing produce, things that you can share with other people. How do you use food, which is a visceral visceral element that just combines people in one space? It's very, you know, people form memories about it and use it to improve their lives in some way. So I just wrapped up my first virtual reality plus food project up in Nicaragua. It was sponsored by a sustainable hotel chain down there. And the idea was to convey, like, what is the beautiful, sustainable things about Nicaragua in this kind of a new way, while being paired with, like, some Nicaraguan food, that as well as cocktails that I prepared with my husband. So we focused on three main facets of Nicaraguan culture. One is coffee. Mm-hmm. A ton of the coffee that we drink is from Nicaragua. Fish, they have access to many different types of fish since they're, you know, next to the Caribbean. They're also next to the ocean. As well as caballo bayo, which is this like Nicaraguan feast sort of thing. It's very traditional. It's really fun. And we did a ton of 360 video across 2 weeks showing the process of coffee being made. It's such a labor intensive process. And then I made this like Tres Leches coffee cake that was inspired by a lot of the desserts that they have there. And my husband created this cocktail pairing. So the idea is that people would be able to watch this VR video, see the coffee, and then also, eat and taste the coffee and like learn about the story in that way, with fish and caballo bayo. And that was great. I think it was a good introductory way to learn about how to use the technology, but I'm now working on something a little bit more intense with VR a little bit more not just based in reality. It's supposed to be a little bit more futuristic looking. I think a lot of the issues that we're facing right now is about, problem between perception and reality. I think if you look at anyone in the U.S. specifically, there's a lot of truth that actually happened, you know, like, and then there's a lot of truth that we tell ourselves, and really being able to dissect that and get people to engage and think about that. Like, everything we think is true is really what we want to think is true. And how do you play with that thought in virtual reality? And so I'm working on essentially building all these scripts of characters and this set so that when you walk in, you sit down, you put on your headset, you listen to these conversations that these characters are having, and you can kind of see where the breakdown occurs between truth and reality. You listen to that conversation for about 5 minutes and you're presented with a dish that specifically focuses on what they were talking about. One of the main topics I want to address is like racism and cultural appropriation. Another one of those topics is toxic masculinity. One of those topics is art. And what is the purpose of art? Is it for consumption or is it for personal satisfaction? What does it entail? How is it related to wealth and all of that stuff? And so the dish itself would also reflect that in the way it's plated. It's the way the actual like plate of the dish is made, whether it's, you know, we can get into that later. But yeah, so it's been a little bit of a stepping stone process of learning how to incorporate it in a way that's going to feel natural and interesting, but also get people to be on their toes a little bit.
Wow. That's definitely deep thinking going on. It's not surface at all. And is I think what you were describing, I was going to ask you about what Studio Italia is doing, but I think you were just describing some of the projects that you have in development or have just completed.
Yes. And then on the AR side, I'm working with this amazing developer to do some augmented plates. So I make ceramics. And the idea mm-hmm. is that I'll make my own ceramics and they'll have a pattern on them. And if you plate, you know, food in the center, you hover your phone across it and you'll see additional visuals on top. So some of the plates I made have, you know, simple like paint splatters on it. And it plates to like a pretty simple dessert, like a ice cream and a cake. But when you hover your phone, you see like kind of the paint splatters coming out of the plate and like enveloping the dessert itself. So it's like kind of interactive. We're working on some things where you can like, there's a hidden target underneath the cake. So as you eat the cake and then you scan the plate again, you see, you know, something else happen that pops out of the plate or something like that. I think that's a little bit more on the lighthearted fun side than the other projects.
Well, and it takes photographing your food to a whole other interactive sort of
yeah.
level that I can see being very popular, although you can also see it getting sort of, maybe I'm getting a bit silly, but out of control where people start to expect that everywhere. So you're just imagining people at a diner with their phones trying to get something to come to life that is otherwise static. So I just wanted to go back to, because I was fascinated by what you were saying, because actually I was just listening to someone else whose name I've forgotten off the top of my head, but is a professor at Yale who was talking about her own research into global behavior and talking about tribes and how people are fundamentally tribal. And as a result, that's oftentimes where this perception and reality is getting mixed up, because if you're always with a like-minded group, you can tell yourselves whatever truths you want and they may be inaccurate. And is that the kind of thing that you were trying to achieve through these dialogues?
Yes, absolutely. I wonder, I'll ask you later, which professor. I've been reading a couple of books about this as well, and the one I'm on right now is called Elephant in the Brain, which there's a big part of that is talking about like the just how we grew out of these like tribal instincts and how it really shapes how we perceive ourselves, how we see other people, and what we want to believe about ourselves. Essentially, the book's premise is a little bit sad, but essentially the idea is that we're basically driven by like very, very selfish desires and needs. And because of that and the competition that arises because we all want more of all of these things is why Homo sapiens has increased its like brain power and intelligence so much farther than, you know, our next in line, like chimpanzees or gorillas or other monkeys. And anyway, the book posits that's why we've developed so much and gives all these interesting data points on like basically how we are able to dissociate, you know, our own selfish desires and how we try to achieve those selfish desires by blanketing them in a more more team friendly viewpoint. So like you might do something that is inherently kind of selfish, but then you tell yourself, well, I did it because for the greater good, for this and this. You know, I could say like, oh, I want to start a studio because I'm trying to be altruistic and give back, but at the same time, is it really because I want to develop my own brand? Is it because I want to be recognized? Is it because I want to make money? Like, just kind of balancing and understanding where that breakdown lies and how to deal with it and, you know, be a little bit more realistic with yourself about who we are.
Yeah, I think I wrote a term paper in high school, and possibly in high school French, that there's no such thing as, you know, or positing, is there such a thing as altruism? Is altruism actually inherently selfish too? But so take that to food. So how do these dialogues result in a dish, and how do you see this sort of dish? I'm assuming if the dish is coming at the end, it's meant to it to be some sort of concluding insight for both parties. Is that sort of what you're thinking you would achieve with this project, or how does the food come into play?
Yeah, exactly. So I'll start kind of from the beginning. When I first got into food, part of the love of food that I think most people have is that it builds a community. And I do believe that food is how you can share culture with other people. If I don't know someone well, but they're from another culture, I always ask them, you know, in Slovenia, what do you guys eat for breakfast? And that starts its own conversation, and you get, you know, into other things, and you get to learn about them through their food. I think it's very beautiful that way. But also, I think there's a mistake in thinking that food itself just builds community. You know, people love to say that at restaurants, at supper clubs, at pop-ups. Like, you stick a bunch of strangers around a table and boom, you suddenly have a community. That's not really the case. I think food builds a community over time because it's so visceral and you're sharing this very physical and emotional, hopefully, if the food is good, state with other people. But how do you actually get people to be in the right state to share their vulnerabilities while they're eating? Because I think that's where you really, you know, you put down some barriers while you're eating. I've been hosting these pop-up series for 4 years now, and we've experimented on all our guests. Different ways of doing this. And now we've learned that there is, I think, a way to build community slowly by, first of all, we have to be vulnerable. And then we ask our guests to be vulnerable by literally asking them hard questions before they even show up. We ask them things like, what is your biggest failure? Or are you in the job you want? And if you're not, how are you going to get there? And these are like uncomfortable things that people don't want to talk about, but we like take their answers. If you don't answer, you can't come. We take their answers. We put them in different places so people will talk to each other. And like, your guard is down. You start eating, your guard comes down a little further, and people are really talking about difficult things over a dinner table instead of, you know, talking about the weather or the subway. So as I was kind of growing off that, I'm like, I think it's really cool and I want to continue doing Wednesdays, but there's something that Wednesdays is missing. And I think part of that is because of social appeasement. When you're around people, you don't want to be that asshole who says like, no, I disagree. You know, I think there's also something beautiful about eating in silence and really thinking to yourself, how do I create the reality that I live in, because you are literally actively building that every day in your mind. And you can't be thinking about these things when you're also trying to engage in conversation and eat your food and think about what the person across from you is drinking and whatever. So the whole idea of VR being a slightly isolationist, I thought was perfect. The idea is you would be listening to conversations, kind of thinking about those conversations with, you know, one conversation slightly tinged with ideas of racism and cultural appropriation, let's say, for an example. After you take the, you come out of the VR headset, you're not seated with anyone else. You're like by yourself eating. There's a spotlight on you. You can't see anything. You're presented with one dish, and that dish will be a manifestation of the conversation. So for this dish, the idea is that, you know, half of it would be kind of like this jagged porcelain plate that serves collard greens, for example, in the way that you would find it at any place in the South, that, you know, a gas station or someone's home. Like, it's just kind of like stir-fried, maybe with a ham hocks or something very simple and classic. And then there's this, like, wooden sculpture that kind of looks like there's chains in it. There's, like, barbed wire, and it grows out. It's like a column that grows out of the porcelain dish at the base of the plate. And it presents like this fancified version of collard greens where there's a puree and there's like perfect little squares of ham and there's, you know, sauce that's been made into a fluid gel. And just showing the juxtaposition of that after you have listened to this conversation, there's no objective. There's no, I'm not saying this is good, this is bad or anything. It's just, why don't you think about this? And how do you feel about it? And what does that mean to you? And then I just hope that people will walk away and kind of think about like, how do I feel about this exhibit? Because most of the time when you go to art museums, you know, good art doesn't tell you to think a certain way. It just gets you to think, period.
Wow. Yeah, no. And that's that. I can feel myself in all the different directions as you were talking of thinking about this and that and the other thing. And I think that kind of stimulation is what leads people to sort of evolve and develop. So we are going to look forward to staying in touch about when this project can come to fruition and be experienced.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm hoping to have like a 2-week run of this as like an exhibit gallery sort of pop up probably in the fall. So I'll definitely let you know. It's definitely been a work in progress, and I'm working with script writers and finalizing a VR studio and starting the food experiments. So we'll see.
Well, it sounds really exciting and really innovative. So we look forward to hearing about that in the fall. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, Jenny's going to reveal her personal Julia moment.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she's inspired them in their career. So Jenny, what's your Julia moment?
So I wish I had like an actual moment with Julia. Of course, that would be amazing. But I think that I've read so much about Julia and read all these quotes by her. And I think that's my favorite, the one that really stuck with me. And I mentioned this concept earlier in the podcast is you can't, you know, really make it or make a difference by just playing it safe. And what I think Julia means to a lot of women chefs like myself is that you can have opinions and you can be contrarian, you can be different, and like that's allowed. I think Julia was criticized a lot for like not being as clean as she should have been in the kitchen. And there's a quote from her somewhere is like, "I don't like those clean people anyway," or something like that. And I just love that because she's like, you know what? I don't care about those people because I'm not cooking for them. She's cooking for herself. She's doing what she wants to do. And like, I think, especially in that era, which I think was not exactly the most woman friendly, that was a very contrarian thing to do. She wasn't trying to please. She was being selfish and she was like, you know, staking her claim. And I remember reading that like a while ago and just thinking, hey, you know what? Like, even despite all the things that she had to deal with in her time, like, you have this fire in you to do something your way. And like, it doesn't matter what other people think. And gosh, why don't more with female chefs like say that now? You know, it's so hard to because you're worrying about how that will affect your Instagram followers or the press that you'll get. And she didn't have to worry about those things and she didn't care. Maybe she did. She was on TV, so she probably did. But alas.
No, I think in certain places she took flack for her opinions. But I think that's poignant to our whole theme that we started with career changers is that I was going to ask you if you thought maybe it helped that she came to what she was doing so late in life at 50. And I think as you get more mature, you do tend to develop a more, I don't care what other people think, attitude, or life's not getting longer, so I better get on with what I really care about. And maybe that's what helped give her the confidence to really have that, you know, contrarian, do what I believe in attitude.
Yeah, I mean, she allowed women to, she said, like, women are allowed to have your own, like, voices. And then I think, yeah, because she was a little older, she was kind of like, you know, she played it safe, basically, for her entire life until then. And look how happy, or, like, you know, eventually she got to a point where she was happy. But, like, think of all those years that she spent trying to figure out what she was doing by like following the well-traveled path. So I think that's something to be said. I mean, I hope that for many people, it doesn't take them until they're 50 to make a big change. But sometimes if it takes you that long, then like just hallelujah that you got there.
Exactly. Well, I think that's a really poignant, Julia, moment. As I said, thank you very much for sharing that. And thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. It was a really interesting conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. We'll look forward to staying in touch. Thanks for listening. Let us know what you think about today's show. You can reach us via email or even send us a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org. Please like us on Facebook. Search at Julia Child. You can follow the foundation on Twitter. Our handle's @JuliaChildJCF and mine's @TSchulkin, T-S-C-H-U-L-K-I-N. We're also on Instagram. Search Julia Child Foundation, all one word. To learn much more about the many lives of Chef Jenny Dorsey, go to jennydorsey.co. It's JennyDorsey.co. You can follow her on social media. Just search @ChefJennyDorsey on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or your favorite social media application. To check out the Why Food podcast, go to heritageradionetwork.org and search Why-Food. Thanks to WGBH for the Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. If you like what you've been hearing, please subscribe. If you like the podcast, please give us a review, as that really helps new listeners discover the program. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.